Good afternoon. This is Craig MacArthur Dolezel, and I'm here speaking with George Bartenev on November 5th, 2016, at his home in Brooklyn, New York. This is Oral History 2 of 3 for the Actors Fund. George, thank you very much for speaking with me again.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Thank you. So, you were speaking about jobs that you've had in your career.
Yes, well, I was speaking about how you start out as an actor, which is part-time. You have to find the right part-time job that allows you still to go to auditions, right? That's the whole game. And so what I found were restaurant jobs. I worked luncheonettes. The first job was really hilarious in a very fast luncheonette on the Lower East Side. And it was a really, really, really busy place. And they said, "Have you ever worked luncheonettes?" I said, "Oh, sure, yeah, of course." And, you know, and I had to work the grill as well as serving customers. I mean, it was really insane and a very high-speed place. Well, I lasted about 2 days in that place. But the next place was really wonderful. It was Whalen's Drugstore, the night shift, which started around 11 o'clock. P.M. and then, you know, went on till, you know, like 6, you know, 7. Everybody who was anybody down and out or, you know, just up late and wanted a quick soda or a hamburger or whatever, they would come to Whalen's. And, I mean, there was really a Damon Runyon clientele. Prostitutes and hipsters and who knows who was dealing in what, you know, but everybody was so interesting. And, you know, I was starting out and studying characters like crazy, so for me it was like an entertainment. And I would call up in the afternoon and say, "Okay, which branch? Okay, go up to 116th Street and Broadway near Columbia. Okay, all right." You know, so every day I had to call in to find out which Whalen's Drugstore needed a relief guy. Okay, so that was one job. The other job was at Top of the Sixes, which was this mixture of the they had two restaurants. One was on the first floor when you came in, and it was sort of a regular, mildly touristy, you know, restaurant where they had a typical American cuisine. And then there was a fancier, double the price, on the roof restaurant. And it was the same, you know, organization. And they would have these huge dumbwaiters that would cook the food downstairs and shove it up in these dumbwaiters. I don't know how it stayed warm, but it must have been heated. But I had the terrible job of having to clean the grills in the kitchen, and the grill was about 60 feet long. Okay, because they had steaks and hamburgers and everything on them, and so they were full of grease. And at night, it was a whole crazy job, you know, cleaning up. But then I would, when I was finished around 2:30 or 3 in the morning, I would raid the ice cream box, you know, and fill myself on ice cream and ginger ale. But you know, that can only go on so long. When I started Theater for the New City in 1970, I had been working on holidays in a wine store. I started out working at very fancy wine store, Sherry Lehman, on about 61st Street and Madison Avenue. And then finally, I worked at this rougher place, but it was a big wine store on 67 and Amsterdam Avenue, right near Lincoln Center. And one day, I actually waited on Balanchine, who came in, you know, looking for a bottle. And you know, I was very, very very, you know, starstruck because, you know, he was so, because of all, my father was a ballet dancer, so it was a big deal for me for him to come in. He was a big celebrity in the histories, stories that I grew up with, and the pictures that I knew, and all about him. But when I was working at TNC, when I started TNC, I had to work at some job in order to make a living. So I worked a day shift at the liquor store, and then at night I went to the theater. So and worked there for another 8 hours. So it was really crazy. I could only do it for 6 months. After 6 months, I was so exhausted. You know, I finally said I gotta quit, and I'll take whatever unemployment gives me. You know, which in those days wasn't much. It was very little. And you always had to show up at unemployment in a suit and tie to show that you were ready to take any job that came along, you know. I mean, I shoveled snow on the Long Island Railroad yards, the railway yards at 34th Street, where all the circus trains used to come in when the annual Ringling Brothers circuses came in from Florida. And for 2 or 3 days, I was out there shoveling the snow off the tracks. Yeah, and you know, stuff like that. You had to take any job that was available in those days, you know, no matter what it was, okay? They didn't just allow you to go for your own job, but after a while, they kind of left that alone because they realized actors have too crazy a life and get too few jobs, you know, and so they shouldn't be held to, you know, the same kind of rules that other people in other kinds of normal jobs have. You know, you have normal jobs and you go home and that's it, you know. They finally left us alone. Oh, he's an actor. Okay, never mind. Yeah, see you next month, you know. I couldn't keep that up after a while. So I just, for the first year, we didn't get a salary at Theater for the New City. There was no money for a salary. We founded the theater. We incorporated it in 1970 because I wanted to make sure we avoided all the hassles that a lot of other theaters, especially experience with the Living Theater, where they never got their not-for-profit status, and they got into a lot of hot water over that, you know. And I actually went to jail with them. At the end of the run of the brig, the IRS came down to collect the $56,000 in back taxes. They insisted that they close the theater, confiscate all the scenery and the lights and the costumes, which by then were totally worthless because we'd been running for a year and a half. It was a poor off-Broadway theater, they did it anyway, and so we staged a special performance. Julian Beck got in. There was a projection window in the back of the theater. It's the only thing that they didn't lock up. So he crawled through the thing. He opened the doors from the inside, and we did this performance to get a lot of publicity for saving the theater, okay? And the only person who gave money was Tennessee Williams, and he gave $500. No one else gave a dime, though Julian and Judith were pictured on the front page of the Daily News behind the barbed wire of the set, okay, as if they were, you know, the prisoners of no money, okay. and which they were always. But anyway, it was a great experience to go to jail with the Living Theater, and the case was called the United States versus Bartenev et al, because my name came B-A before B-E-C-K, Julian Beck. So they just simply put the they listed us alphabetically in the legal deposition. So, but they finally dismissed the whole cast after we all went through the hearings. But they put us in a federal prison. Because they said, "Listen, this is not a misdemeanor. This is a felony. Okay, so you better decide if you want to go to jail." But many of us had already done the sit-in at the theater to protest. That the theater was threatened with closing, and so we all wanted to save this theater, and. It was really it was my first experience of going to jail for an idea, or for the idea that I always believed in. And besides, that particular play was anyone who was in that particular play was very passionate about the play and what they were doing and how they were doing it. It was an extraordinary experience in that way. But the funniest thing, we got into this jail, which was on West Street, on the river, okay, Hudson River. It used to be a garage building, and they had put cages inside the structure, okay? So we were in this cage with 20 other guys. And we had been there about a half hour, and a guy comes over and he says, "What are you in for?" And he said, "What? What'd you say? Say that again. You did what? You sat? You sat on what? Where did you sit? Hey, Jim, come here. Yeah, go ahead, tell him. Hey, you don't listen to this." I mean, it was a big deal prison because there were Russian spies in it. There were, the guy behind the guy behind the guy in Newark. And, big time people, all right? And so you were in jail, you are, your status is the nature of your crime, okay? What is the nature of your crime gave you the status, okay? So anyway, they dismissed us after one night because they figured we were all brainwashed. So they only prosecuted Julian and Judith, who later stayed, had to spend 6 months in a upstate, no, Connecticut federal prison. But they were used to going to prison for their ideals and for what they believed in. They had a long history of that, and after that when they self-exiled themselves in order to keep going, they exiled themselves to Europe because they could never pay that debt. There was no way to, nobody came forward to say, "Oh yeah, this is a very important theater, let's put up the money, let's raise the money." Nobody did that. Nobody came forward. They exiled themselves and they created a whole other, much more physical style of theater that didn't demand, that excluded language to a very simple level. It was mostly physicalized theater, what they called the Meyerhold biodynamic, theater, and they just, you know, changed their whole style, and of course it became even more political, it became even more extremely political, and I said, I don't want to do theater that's just physical. You know, by that time, I really began making choices. I had always, my experience in the theater was always a question of evolution. From one style of theater that I first went into, which was in the beginning pure classical theater. I wanted to just join, you know, repertory companies and play all the roles that I wanted to play. But nobody ever gave me or even let me audition for the main roles. They were always like character roles. And after a while, it just got very boring. That's why when my wife of that time, we were in that company together. It was Andre Gregory's company in Philadelphia. And Andre Gregory had come to us and said, I want to form a company where the actors and the director are collaborators in everything. Okay, you choose the material, you choose what parts you want to play. You know, we work on it together, you know, we develop it together and so on and so forth. Well, it didn't quite turn out that way. So in the end, it was the same, it turned out to be the same system that mostly exists in every other repertory company throughout the States, where there usually starts off in the first couple of years, there's a core company, people who want to work very much with this artistic director. But after a while, only certain people get the leads in that company, you know, and the other people are relegated to lesser roles. And it stays that way. It doesn't really change. And that's the thing that I began to really be bored with and pissed off about. That was when, this was in 1966, 67, okay, when there was this big flower power march in New York against the war in Vietnam. And it was called the Angry Arts Against the War. And it was a lot of little theaters up and down the East Coast who collaborated or did their own thing under the banner of Angry Arts Against the War in Vietnam. And many of the people were people that I had already begun to know at Judson Memorial Church, where I worked for 6 years from 62 to 68, so I knew those people, and they gave us material, and they said, why don't you work on this material? Well, by then we had already started. My wife and I started to do poetry programs in black high schools in Philadelphia, and it was fantastic. It really was fantastic, because we called the program Revolution USA, and we selected all American poets who at any time were rebels or had a new vision of what America, what was important about America, and so on and so forth. And they were all famous writers, Whitman, and we even found writers who were a couple of writers from the 18th century, and then of course Whitman and a lot of early 19th century, and then we came up to Leroy Jones and Langston Hughes, you know, Amiri Baraka. He was once he renamed himself Amiri Baraka, but And there was my wife standing in a white prom dress, okay, that she wore for this occasion, okay, and I was in some kind of simple but slightly hipster outfit. And she says, she started with a poem by Langston Hughes, which said, "I am black," and there was a huge roar from the balcony because these kids had never been a poetry slam like this in the school, reading this kind of stuff, but for a white girl to say, you know, "I am black," it created a huge uproar, because of course, you know, they saw who it was, and at the same time, it was kind of cool that somebody who is white identifies themselves that way. To put it in the contrast, the juxtaposition creates a whole other meaning, you know, that you say that you are black, okay? You know, it's like people who are, they do this all the time in a bunch of movies where somebody's committed a crime, a rebellious act, okay? And they say, okay, and they get everybody out together, and they get them out in a crowd, and they say, okay, who is Spartacus? You know, and they say, "I am Spartacus, I am Spartacus, I am Spartacus," you know. And so anyway, that was the sort of juxtaposition that created, and kids came up to us later and said, "Oh, I love that word stuff. Oh, that word stuff, man, that is really cool. That is fantastic, really the cool stuff," you know. And so we got a great charge out of that. And then along came the Angry Arts organization, and they gave us like three or four plays, little skits. And they were, you know, like satire. They were political satire. And so we said, how are we going to do this? So, you know, we had seen, I had seen street theater, but we were asked to perform it in the Sheep's Meadow in Central Park, to come to New York and perform it. And at that time, we were still employed by Andre's company in Philadelphia. So anyway, I put on a suit and tie, and we came with little suitcases, and we came to Sheep's Meadow, and there was Peter Schumann, Bread and Puppet Theater, performing on top of an open bed truck. And it was, we thought it was really fantastic. It was the first time. I had just seen his work in the parade. We were first in the parade, the Flower Power protest march on Fifth Avenue, and I'd seen this incredible thing that he did in that parade. And so this was a play that he put together with big puppets and stuff, and we just thought it was amazing. And so, and then we came on there fully dressed, you know, in our little conventional clothes. And then we took all our clothes off except our underwear, and then we put on clown outfits, and then we did the skits, okay? And Peter just loved it, okay? He said, "It's very good, very good." And that night we were invited to a party where Stefan Brecht was, who was the son of Helen Weigel, you know, Brecht's wife. And Stefan Brecht was, he still spoke with a little German accent, but he was passionate about the whole off-Broadway movement, because everything that was happening that was really exciting was happening downtown. And so he wrote a big, amazing book about the scene, and he started acting in different with different companies, off Broadway, different really wild companies like the Ridiculous Theater Company and the Theater of the Ridiculous. They were two companies that split, and one called themselves the Ridiculous Theater, and one called themselves the Theater of the Ridiculous. And they were both very good, but they were very, very, very different. But just to roll back a little bit, okay? I want to roll back a little bit to the beginning of 1960. Literally, 1960 was a huge, huge, huge major turning point for me, because up to that time, I had been in a couple of... I worked at Washington Arena, and I'd worked at Hartford Stage Company, and then I did a couple of, you know, I did some readings and some, you know, other... I was another... right after I came back from my conservatory training in England, I got into two plays immediately. One was a company called Theater 20, and they were all graduates from some college, and they formed a company and called themselves Theater 20, and they did a play called Alcestis. It was a Greek play, and I don't remember if it's Euripides or anyway. I played head of the chorus. And that was okay. That was great. It was fun to, you know, be back in New York and, you know, get a job pretty much right away. And then a little bit later, I got a job in which a wonderful actor played, who had just graduated from City College. His name was Jimmy Coco. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he was a comic actor in New York who had a very strong career in the 60s, playing many parts. The play that they were doing was Salome, okay? Oscar Wilde's Salome, and an unfinished play by Oscar Wilde, which was finished by a disciple of his called The Merchant of Padua, and never done. It's never done. And they made it a double bill. And Jimmy Coco played Herod, the emperor. And in the first play, in the Salome, I played the third Jew from the left. And then in the second play, I played the merchant of Padua, okay, who gets cuckolded by a young, you know, adventurer who comes to buy. He's a material brocade seller. He sells expensive, cloth and materials for people to make costumes to take to their tailor and so on and so on. And so this guy comes and wants to order something, and he starts coming out to the wife and finally has this affair, and then the merchant plots his how he's going to kill him. It's a funny little thing, right? Anyway, and those were the days when after I'd auditioned, I came back for an interview, and I said, "Are you going to take me?" The director turned to the producer, and he said, "Well, we're discussing it." I said, "Well, listen, if you don't take me with my background, you're crazy." Now, you know, I mean, those were the days when, you know, I felt, hey, listen, I spent 4 years in England. I got two good reviews in the London Times, one for acting and one for directing. And I also did a couple of illegal jobs as an actor outside of London under another family name that I used. You know, so listen, I had experience, and while in my sophomore or senior year at Guildhall, a bunch of us decided to, we were graduating next year, so we said, hey, let's go, somebody here knows of a company in Cornwall that's been dormant for a bunch of years. Why don't you go there and, you know, reopen this theater. It's a summer resort, and they have a beach and everything, you know, and it's the only theater in town. So, you know, so we went, and it rained every day. And you know what? Nobody had anywhere to go. There was no movie theater. So they came to the theater every night. And it was packed. And we did all these Boilermaker, you know, successes, Dial M for Murder and you know, Hay Fever and all the fun, you know, light, frothy plays. And then we did one play The Deep Blue Sea, okay? And I think it's Terence Rattigan, the British playwright. And in it, I played a German doctor, and I played this German doctor who saves a young woman from committing suicide. It's at the beginning of the play. The young girl whose life I saved was Eileen Atkins, okay? It was like 21, all right? And she had been to Guildhall. We had not been there the same year, but she had been there the year before. And so she knew the young people who were organizing the company together, you know, organizing the company out of these graduates from Guildhall. And we had a director who, another good director, from a young man from Greece, from Athens, who was a graduate, who just graduated. And so, you know, we put together this whole season. So that was a wonderful experience for me, because, you know, of putting something together at a very young age, you know, just out of pure enthusiasm and hey, why don't we do it? You know, it's an empty theater. You know, how could we go wrong? And really, I mean, we were so lucky that it rained every day. I mean,
Do you recall what that producer said to you after you? Do you recall what that producer said to you after you shared your plethora of
experience? Oh, yeah. You mean after I said, if you don't take me, you're crazy? He did a double take to the producer. You know, he looked, what did he say? He stuttered and stumbled, and well, we certainly are considering, you know. And then he said yes. That's it, you know. I once got a Broadway job like that. I read a script, and it was so bad. I said, this is like they threw out every bad soap opera script, and then they patched it together, and they said, let's do this as a play, okay? It was that bad. But it had Joe Malzina, you know, the famous Joe Malzina, who designed, you know, in those days, he designed every other set, and he was really a very fine set designer for Broadway. He was, you know, absolutely great. And he had to design, in this case, a set that was the hillside of Malibu Beach, okay, with all the houses on it, okay, going up the hill. So the houses kept going up to beyond the proscenium, okay, and it was it's a very steep slope, all right? And so I thought, this was a cold reading, okay? We were only allowed to read the script, you know, and then go on, okay? And they tell you what part they want you to read for. So I go on stage, I said, you don't want me for this. I handed the script into the darkness, okay? You don't want me for this. It's not for me. And a voice from the darkness said, that's exactly the quality we're looking for. Could you read page 15, please? So I read page 15 and I got the role. And I said to myself, I'm crazy, but okay, I'm employed. It's my third or fourth Broadway show. You know, I'm not going to, you know, give it up at this point. Well, it was so bad that it closed during previews. Okay. It had a moment in the play where there was a Coast Guard siren went off because somebody was drowning and they had to go save them. And the tape broke backstage. In those days, you know, they had these big tape recorders with big wheels and lots of tape. The tape snapped. And the stage manager is just backstage going, and you could not hear a line for the next 5 minutes because there was so much laughter from the audience. It was, you know, really, really, but that was an indication, you know, when a show is really that bad, things happen that say, yeah, you should close.
So tell me more about this turning point in your career.
Yes. So let's get back to the meat and potatoes. 1960 was the real turning point for me. So what happened was I went to the Living Theater to see this controversial production of The Connection, which was about heroin addiction in the jazz world, okay? And there was a live jazz band on stage, and the actor really shot up, or it was totally, you know, realistic, or you believed he shot up, and also, you know, the acting was just amazing, and the whole production was absolutely amazing. They had really destroyed the fourth wall, and you really felt like you're in the room. You're just sitting in the back of the room in which these people live. That's the feeling you got, and it was just totally electrifying and mind blowing that you could really, 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 really create that reality. And in the intermission, one of the musicians comes up to you and says, "Hey, man, I really need some money. You know, I really need some money, man. You know, can you give me just anything? You know, okay. I gotta have it. I can't finish the show if I don't get the money, because the guy is coming for his money, you know, okay? And with some stuff, you know, I gotta. And you could not tell. You absolutely could not tell. Is this real? You know, is it real, or is it part of the show? Or, you know? You know, it was the Living Theater. And I said to myself, I've got to get into a company that can do things like this. This is the first time that I really got electrified by a company of actors that had a style, had a philosophy. I mean, they were anarchists, and Judith and Julian were both anarchists who believed, as they put it, in the beautiful, peaceful, pacifist revolution, okay, and they both believed it and practiced what they preached, but you know, so for 2 years I tried to get in the company. I auditioned, I got nowhere, and finally, so I starred in 1962. I got, right after, okay, that, seeing that and wanting to get into that company, I got into Judson, Maybe I've told this already, but I met this beat poet who was a Catholic. He was also Catholic, and he was the first beat Catholic poet I knew. And I knew him from 10th Street between B and C. And he said, "Hey, man, I want you to meet this guy. He's a director, and he's doing a showcase over there in that church. You know, you should check it out." I said, "Oh, okay. So yeah, sure. You know, it's probably awful." And I went over, but I checked it out. It turned out to be a new play in iambic pentameter, written in iambic. Completely, the whole play was written in verse and good verse in iambic pentameter, and it was written by a prominent beat poet of the time, who later became a very prominent teacher of poetry, William Packard. And the play was called In the First Place, and it was basically about artists, you know, who were in the insane asylum and were the only sane people, and that the people who ran the insane asylum were crazy. But I started working at Judson, and I got into this wonderful play by De Gelderode, who's a Flemish playwright, called Pantagruel, about a professor of philosophy who gets caught up in a revolution quite inadvertently, because he's standing on the corner of a street and he says, "What a beautiful day." And that happens to be the cue line for a code word that somebody is waiting for in order to start the revolution. And so as soon as he says it, all hell breaks loose, you know, and the revolution starts. And then it turns out all the revolutionaries become reactionary. And of course, that's the point of the play. But and then I was in the first play by Irene Fornes, and the first play by Rosalind Drexler, both of which went off Broadway from Judson, okay? While I was doing those two things, I suddenly heard that Joe Chaykin, one of the prominent actors of the Living Theatre, was leaving the Living Theatre to form his own company. And they were looking for an actor to play the lead in The Dog Beneath the Skin by W.H. Auden, another play in verse, a poetic play. And I read for it, I auditioned for it, and I got the part. And I thought, wow, finally, you know. And then one day I got a phone call from Julian. And he says, "George, I don't know how to tell you this, but we're not doing Dog Beneath the Skin." And I thought, oh God, where's my bottle of, you know, let me die now. And so he said, "But we just, a young playwright came to the door and we read the play and we've changed all our plans. We've got to do this play and you can play any number you like." And I said, "Any number?" He said, "What do you mean?" "Well, there are 10 prisoners, and you can play any number between 1 and 10. So I see. Okay. Well, I read the script, and my hair stood up on my arms and my head, back of my head, and I thought, wow, yes, you got to do this play, because it's really incredible. And that turned out to be The Brig, okay, about a Marine prison, a real Marine prison, which the playwright had been in Okinawa right after the war. And it's a day in the life of, you know, a prisoner in the brig. And it's really one of the most incredible combinations of physicality, and it's, which becomes almost like dance. Because what he did very brilliantly was he picked all the scenes are absolutely absolutely real in every detail, okay? And the playwright instructed us during rehearsals on every physical move in the play and so on. He was there all the time. And it is also, he has picked very minimalist text, which just tells the story, okay? And when you put the two together, it's like this surreal, poetic horror show of cruelty of man to man, you know, in the world. It's a theater of Antoine Artaud, you know, the theater of cruelty that was kind of the sensation of the moment. And what you had to do as an actor was, you know, forget everything you ever did before. Here I was a classical actor, and there was one other classically trained actor who had auditioned and got into it. And after a week of rehearsal, he said, "I can't do this. There's nothing in here for me," you know. So he was gone. But I said, you know, this is really so amazing. I've got to do this. I've got to go through this. And I played this part of number eight, okay, that's what I started with, prisoner number eight, who has one little scene, okay, otherwise he's doing everything that everybody else does. Everybody else, of all the prisoners, only three had real scenes. All the rest just had to do the routine, but really do it for real. And none of it involved anything remotely that you had learned as an actor, no matter what school you went to, because you just had to be there fully from moment to moment, you know, dealing with what you had to deal with physically and emotionally, but you because the prison, the thing about the Marine prison is it's not about punishing you, it's about redisciplining you, because you went AWOL and had hung out in a brothel for 3 days, you know, and you're so you became a slob, and you know you completely lost your Marine discipline, self-discipline, right? So the idea of the prison is to make you a super Marine. So you have to do 25 push-ups all the time, you have to do this, you have to do that. And they put the rules of the prison in the program so that if you broke any rule by mistake, and you could because you had to stand at attention all the time, and not look where you were going. You weren't allowed to look down. You had to look straight forward. And of course, there were many white lines all over the stage. Wherever there was an entrance, either into a corridor or the cage where all the bunks were. So if you stepped on a white line, they had to play an improv with you. Okay, they had to and make up a punishment with you. And since there were always like two or three replacements, they really had to be disciplined a lot. And if you did it too many times, you broke the rhythm of the play. And the play was highly rhythmic. And in fact, it was like a Bach fugue, you know, because there was always something else going on that also had to be timed. You know, so it was just an amazing piece, and anybody who was in it, well, there were about three or four of us who really were became fanatic about doing it really, really, really correctly, and then there were a lot of people who were just like, oh, you know, money, but you know, they eventually at least got into some shape, but you know, it took a lot of work, and we used to drill half an hour with real Marine drill sergeants for before every rehearsal, okay? And, you know, there were people who really did flip out. And there was one one character in the play who actually does flip out, and they beat him up and carry him out. And I finally got to play that part, and that was great. It was absolutely a great release of being very pent up for a long time, except for the physicality of the play. But I mean, the play caused an enormous reaction in the audience, all the time, you know, because there was nothing like it in New York at all. I don't think anybody had seen anything like it, as a physical endurance, you know.